Accession number 14981, William Cornell, Reel 4.
Mr. Cornell, Reel 4. The 10th Battalion had gone to Iceland, Mr. Cornell, so you must have left them at some point.
Yes, now this was the time when I went to the traffic control company, when I had the chance of this job, and I took it. But my friend, I lost my best pal, went with them to Iceland, and we used to meet occasionally on leave, where he used to tell me all about being stationed in Reykjavik in Iceland, and about how the Icelanders, the people themselves, wouldn't accept them at all. They were practically hated, and some awful tales about them. But as I said, separated from my best pal, but however that was that.
Can you describe to me now the duties that you are now doing?
Yes. Now, the duties of the traffic control company. Now, at this time, the British Army, or the British forces, complete in UK, were getting better equipped, and more in numbers, and in other words, there was much more movement on the roads, and troops were always on the move in convoys of lorries, sometimes 100 lorries of various descriptions in one convoy, and they were moved from place to place. Now, to make life easier for both the civilian traffic and the army traffic, the drivers themselves, the traffic control companies would perform. Now, these, you lived as a group. It wasn't a very big group. I think you'd only be about 50 men, including that's your commanding officer and your various NCOs, and the actual. Now, we all had a motorcycle. Now, when there was a convoy going to move, you had an area which covered quite a number of 100 square miles or so, and in that area, you were responsible as a company, the traffic control company, of ensuring that convoy entered your area and left your area in complete safety and with a little hassle and everything else. And so that was our duty. So it meant that every major crossroad where that convoy was going to travel through had to be manned by a man given directions which to go to and control the traffic and stop the mix-up with the civilian traffic, etc. So what you were doing, you're given a map and a reference point, and you were given your haversack rashes for the day, and you went off on your motorcycle with your map, and you took your particular way you'd been lot, the map reference, and you went and there, you stood there, sometimes 10, 20 hours on duty, waiting for the convoy, sometimes on time, sometimes they were late. But when they arrived, your duty was to get them over that point as quickly and with as little problem as possible. And then when the last man had gone, you were given a signal by one of your own dispatch riders, followed them along and told each man, right, the convoy had gone, to return back to your unit, which our case was in what was called the Old Mill Hostel, because it had been an old flour mill hostel in Salisbury itself, in Wiltshire.
This must have brought you into clash from time to time with civilian traffic.
Yes, there was no problems really, but the biggest problems was some of the drivers in the convoys. They had a habit of some good drivers, but also some bad ones, and sometimes they wouldn't keep the distances correct. It was your duty to, if you saw a gap in a convoy and the man coming up behind the one that was actually passing you, the distance was too great, you'd give them the signal to accelerate and to catch up and to close up all the time. In other words, you had to keep them information, not let them struggle over anywhere they wanted to go.
What kind of distance would there be between two
vehicles? Oh, it could be any time. It could be day or night. It could be any time in the 24 hours.
And the distance between the vehicles?
Yes.
What was the statutory distance?
Well, in daytime, it was not, I would think about 100 yards at the most, round about 100 yards. But at night time, they were closer, because there was no lights allowed here. But what happened was all army troops that time were equipped with a small light, which was on the rear of the vehicle, and it shone onto a white bit of paint on the differential of the back axle of the truck in front. And it was the driver behind, to keep that in sight all the time. with that, so he managed without the lights. On the other hand, with the light being underneath the lorry, it didn't give any aircraft the position to anything.
So if you're on a crossroad and you have civilian vehicles coming, mm-hmm. what was the procedure for controlling that?
Oh, you had to stop the civilian. The convoy had to have priority all the time.
How long might they be stopped?
Well, it depends on the length of the convoy. An hour, 2 hours, but in most cases, mostly it was local traffic you were talking about, the civilian part of it, for the simple reason petrol ration was on, and so the traffic was local, and there wasn't all that much of that either. But being local, they probably knew an alternative of getting to where they wanted to go without disturbing the convoy. And that was their problem for hours.
How was your company organised?
Well, as I said before, it was roughly a company of about 70 men. And that company, it was a complete unit, self-contained unit. You had your commanding officer who received the information about the which convoy was going to pass your area and things like that. In other words, they knew what was happening, and it was passed on down the lines from there on. Now, in that group of 60, 70 men, you had you had the motorcycles. Now, for the motorcycles in the unit, you had a motorcycle fitter, who kept the machines in repair and things like that. Now, the training you had was the correct signals to give to stop and to advance way on, quick speed up and things like that. And that was the only specific training as regards this company was concerned. But on top of that, you had your normal soldier duties, which were adhered to all the time. That was your normal training went on with your rifle, your drills and your guards and everything else. But as time wore on, the convoys got bigger and more frequent. And so basically, the Latinx, it was purely on duty all the time. Sometimes you're on duty in spells of 24 hours even, on duty all the time. No doubt you couldn't do what you want. You couldn't sleep or anything like that. But there were periods, there were slack periods between convoys where even if it was the same point, you could sit down on the grass and have a little sleep till you heard something coming again and things like that. And as I said, they were enjoyable times. And I was given for a good period, which I enjoyed again, because it was better still even than the traffic control duties. I was given the position of group dispatch rider, because whereas I said we were in a company, this company was only part of a group, and group was the headquarters of a number of these traffic control companies. And as a group dispatch rider, it was a job against the world for me, because it was purely and simply dispatch riding, and that included. You actually had 12 hours on duty, and this was on a roster basin again. But after finishing 12 hours of duty, where you could be on go all the time, you had 24 off to do with what you want. So it was a beautiful life. Now, in your 12 hours on duty, now what happened in the group desire, you had what you call dispatch rider's room. And in that room, there was a proper little camp bed, and you could do anything you want. You could read. You could go to sleep, you could do anything, but you were on call, in other words. You had a minute's notice, you had to be ready to move. And I remember quite well in them days that for something to do, I learned to typewrite with the office staff. One of the coppers taught me how to use the typewriter just as something to do. And it was a grand time, but you couldn't get a hectic time. Now, you're 12 hours on duty. Sometimes, not very often, but sometimes in that 12 hours on duty, you never moved out the building. There was nowhere to go yet. Do what you want. Read, sail, and type anything you want. Another time, you wouldn't get a minute. Your convoy would go out, dispatch rider, go there, go here, go there. Even as far as I remember on one occasion, memory's a little bit dim, but I had to go to the War Office in London on two dispatches, with dispatches at times. Another time, I had to go to Wilton. Now, Wilton House is not far from Salisbury, and at that time it was the headquarters of, I think, General Alexander, if I remember rightly. And on occasion I did deliver actual dispatches, personal matters, personally to him himself that time. So it was really great times.
What were your impressions of him?
Gentleman, as far as I could say. Absolute gentleman. Soldier, but a gentleman. Always polite, never grim and gruff with you, but a soldier for all that. And as I said, this was just a few minutes more, but of course, it was certain, delivers this area, the majority of stuff, when you had a dispatch to take, you took it, was in a sealed envelope, whatever, and you took it and you just delivered it to the owner. But in cases like that, there was personal things which you were, had to deliver personally, that particular person. In other words, there was, you just saw the staff and you explained it was a personal message, and you were taken to the door of the room and knocked and entered and took in to deliver it personally, and that was it, out again, and signed for it in the book, and away you went home again.
What did you carry the dispatches in?
Just a little haversack, actually. As I said, I'd got a bit better motorbike, I didn't mention this time. Previously I had the BSA, which was a great big heavy machine. That was very small and very sluggish. It was a rather dull motorcycle to drive, but I was given a 350 aerial for this job, which was much faster and much more like the civilian bikes. And I really enjoyed it.
What was the uniform that you wore riding your
yes,
bicycle?
Well, you only had your normal uniform, but on top of that you had a black leather helmet and a pair of goggles and a pair of heavy motorcycle boots which came up your leg. But that was the only addition to your normal uniform which you had.
How was your bike maintained? Did you do that yourself?
No. Each unit had its own, as I said before, mechanic, fitter. And if you had to report any fault whatsoever, there was a proper form for it. If you had any troubles with your machine at all, you had to do it. You weren't allowed to touch it yourself, actually. The only thing you were allowed to do, in fact, you were enforced to do, was whenever you left your motorcycle, you had to immobilise it. You took the defibrillators out or whatever on a car. If it was a motorbike, you took the plug lead with you.
Were the speed limits laid down in the country at that time for you?
Not really. You just had to observe the civilian speed limits. But I can never, on any occasion, remember anybody being punished for exceeding the speed limit.
What kind of thing might a cyclist do to get punished?
For damaging your machine in any way, was obviously because the machine was more important than you, actually. You could replace it, but the motorbike was harder to replace. But any damage to the machine, you know, you had to, whereas you didn't repair it yourself, you had to maintain it, you had to make sure it had oil and stuff like that in. Now, if you accidentally forgot to put the oil in, you save the engine, you're in serious trouble. You'd be punished accordingly. But the machines, they were fairly reliable. There was danger involved, because quite a few of the dispatch riders were killed. And because you had to go out, that's the important thing, you had to drive out with a message in, come what may, the weather, even ice, snow, come what may, you had to take that message, it was up to you to get there. And many a time in harsh weather and icy conditions, it was nothing before you'd, in a journey of probably 20 miles, you'd fallen off your motorbike about 6 or 7 times and picked yourself up and just had another go and things like that. There was quite a few killed. I remember I came across one chap, a dispatch rider, going the opposite way to me, and I came across it somewhere near Salisbury, near Warminster, I think, and saw the motorbike lying first on the side of the road, and just a little bit further on, there was a van, a civilian van, and then I came across the dispatch rider, and he had both legs chopped off in this accident with the van. Of course, he was still alive. But I went as fast as I could to the next little village, got the telephone reported back, tried to get an ambulance out to him, and I saw the ambulance arrive, the army ambulance that was, of course, and then, of course, I had to carry on with my duties, just go to where I was supposed to be going. Of course, it was a busy area, Wiltshire, in those days, because you had all these big camps, you had the tanks at Warminster, there was Lark Hill, all these surrounding places, Salisbury Plain for the train, and it was a very busy area, and that was why it was all these convoys coming and going all the time. But they were happy days. But eventually I got bored with them, and the old thing returned about, I want a bit more excitement. Looking back, I don't know why. But I decided that I had enough of that life, but there was no way of getting it out. But one day they came up, and there was a notice posted upon the board. volunteers to serve abroad. And I put my name down straight away. I said, no, I want to say some sort instead of all this. It's all right, but I've been in the army a few years now and I've said nothing, which I hadn't. So I put my name on the board, and another two or three did the same. And eventually got called in front of the CEO, and he said, I can't tell you where. He says, if you want to be post-prop, but he says, I can't tell you. You will retain your badge, your DLI, and you will be a DLI battalion. But he says, which battalion? I'm not allowed to tell you, or even what country you're going to. Well, at that time, really, most of the action was in the Middle East, of course. And my old friend, 50th Div, was 6th Battalion, and 8th and 10th Battalion, and the 11th Battalion, were in the Middle East at this particular time. So I thought, oh, I'm going to see my old friends again. So anyway, I was joined, and we were accepted. We had quite a few, you know, special physical examinations, so we're still all right, everything all right. And so, all right, we were posted within a week after that to Bransworth Camp, which was headquarters of the DLI in them days, at Bransworth in County Durham.
Do you recall when this was?
Yes, this would be 1943. I think it was 1943, I'm practically certain. 43. And so we were posted back to Bransworth Camp. Now, for all I'd been the DLI stamps, it's the first time I'd ever been to Bransworth Camp, because I'd been with the battalions out all the time, whereas Bransworth was purely a training camp. And didn't like it one little bit, because it went right back to the rookie stage, back to training and training and training, marching and all the rest of it. And after being a nice life on the motorbikes, I didn't go particularly well with it. However, it wasn't very long before we were told that we were being posted. So we were given our equipment, which believe not included the topi and the khaki drill suits. So we still had no idea where we were going, of course. So one day you go on, you leave this camp tomorrow, and we move from Bransworth Camp, and we're this small unit, there's about maybe 40 of us, we're put into. It's still there. I think it's a Methodist church in Durham City. And we were in there overnight. We slept on the floor. The next morning we were surrounded by red caps, the military police, and we escorted to the station, put on a train. Still didn't know where we were going, but from the observations out of the window I knew we were going north. And eventually we landed up at Greenock in Scotland. So getting near to where the boats were, obviously. So we were marched off the Downs, down to the docks at Greenock, and there was this massive old ship. It was the biggest thing I've ever seen in my life. And it was a ship, and it still had the name on it. It was called the Multan. It was an old P&O liner, about 28,000 tons. It was a big boat. And looked up north and said, we're going on there. And an old ship, though, of course. And one thing that did stick out in mind, whereas we weren't told where we were going, even at this stage we had no idea where, but still assumed it was the Middle East. However, believe it or not, for all the security of those wartime days, as we were waiting to walk up this into one of the access places of the ships, it was like a gangplank up into a hole in the side of the ship where you went into, the cranes were loading up, and believe it or not, on some of the boxes, what were going on, these great big black stencil letters, was the word Bombay. Now, how that came about, I never know, but you talk about security. If I could say that, anybody could say that. And I thought, oh, it's a red herring, this. It's just a false thing to put anywhere, you know, because, of course, U-boats was the thing in them days. However, we got on board, and within 24 hours, up anchor and away we went. We sailed.
Do you remember the date you sailed?
Not exactly, no. I remember the time I was on the boat, like the date's gone completely. But I remember the ship going up the plank onto it, sailing down the river, the Clyde, and past all the shipyards, and the shipyard workers cheering as we went past on this great big ship. And we went out into the Irish Sea.
What was life like on board ship?
It was pretty desperate, right from day one. Now, we lived in mess decks, and I think they went in ABCDs, and I was somewhere right on the bottom, because I remember it was no port, or was it miles below the water line. And you were in this dreadful thing, and you slept in hammocks, of course. You had hammocks strung next to 101 little room, right, strung from the roof on these hooks, the hammocks. And
how did you find them?
Difficult, especially getting into one. However, you like everything else, you learn fast when you have to. But on the first day out, as I say, we sailed at night, and in the morning we were out into the Irish Sea. And I was in my hammock, I was feeling grand, I was all right, I was going to where I wanted, I was going to see some soldiering. And I was quite content, I wasn't worried about U-boats or nothing else. But for some reason, I just happened to glance down from my hammock, and just below me on the side of the mess deck, there was the racks where you kept your rifles, they were all stood up on end. And I noticed them, they start going to the left, clattering to where the stop was, and it fall over the other way. And for no other apparent reason, I felt violently. I was going to be sick violently. And I was. I managed to the ablutions, and I was violently sick. And I was sick for the next 2 days. That was going through the Irish Sea. And my first experience of seasickness, and I didn't enjoy it one little bit. It was terrible.
Did they leave you alone in your
No,
misery?
They didn't. You were taunted with it. You were taunted by the talk of greasy bacon and all this thing, just to help you along. And
but the army then.
Oh no, there was no care. No, no. The food was put out. You couldn't look at it. Never mind, ate it. But you had no special, no seasickness pills, no nothing like that. But however, after about the second day, it did pass away, and I felt a little bit more like myself and started getting about the ship a bit, which was again enjoyable. That part was where conditions were grim, the way you lived together in close proximity and slept together and all the rest of it, and there was nothing organised in them early days, the first 2 or 3 days. Later on you had your games were organised and tombola and all that sort of thing. Housey-housey, you used to call it. And that was the first 2 days where I remember the sea was very rough. That was going through the Irish Sea.
Did you have any training to do on board ship?
Yes, you had your duties again, which were mostly fire pickets. And on your fire picket duties, you were posted to various parts of the ship, into the holds, near the watertight doors, various places, sometimes right in the front of the boat, sometimes at the rear, various places. And that was your duty again, just to look for fire. And that was your fire guard all the time. And that was very, very strict, that. If you were caught asleep or anything like that, you were in serious trouble. Because, understand me, it could be serious.
How long would that particular duty be?
The duty is the same as normal, 2 on and 4 off. 2 on and 4 off.
As a 24-hour duty?
Oh, yes, over a 24-hour period of the full guard time.
Were there other drills and activities that you had to do?
Yes, you had. When all said and done, I forget. I think we were talking about 3,000 troops on this ship, and space was strictly limited, but the limited part that there was, you couldn't go marching about a rope march and anything like that, but you were given really tough PT in groups of PTs in every available space. And of course you had your lifeboat drills and all that sort of thing. You had your position where you had to go to in case of emergency, all of that, how to react to them, and you had all that on top of it. But by and large, it was the first time I'd ever been on a big ship, and once I got used to this up and down bit, I was quite happy about it. And I used to explore the ship and get there. Most of us, you weren't allowed to go, because the officers were completely segregated from the troops, and they out of bound their quarters. You couldn't go anywhere near them, of course.
If the officers were segregated, who looked after you?
Well, you had your NCOs, your other ranking NCOs. But the officers did still look after you, but they came to visit you. You never visited them. They came down to you to take you for a PT lesson with your PT instructor and things like that. So you didn't lose sight of them, far from it. But they had their own special conditions, which were far superior to what the troops were, obviously.
Did this kind of thing annoy you, that officers were
No, not really. It did bother me one little bit. I was on a ship and I was going to do something which I wanted to do. Sounds strange, but that's the way I felt in those days. I had no fear whatsoever, even submarines or anything else. To me, it was just all excitement, and that's as simple as that. And I'm not trying to make it sound like bravado, it's just the way I felt at the time.
Were you inspected regularly?
Yes, oh yes, you had to keep yourself clean, you had your morning inspections and things like that. The place where you had to be spot was clean, the mess deck where you lived, your hammocks had to be stowed on a morning, and the mess deck table set up there, because in the same place you slept and you lived and you ate. The only time you went out of that deck was for your, when you went to space on the decks for your PT training and your fire duties and things like that. So you lived in this area, maybe it's 100 people in a, what you would call, right, for 100 people, a very small room, I would say.
Who carried out the inspections?
Oh, the officers would always carry those out. Preliminary, you would have your sergeant majors, your sergeant majors, and then if they were satisfied with them, then you had the officer would come and give the final inspection. And you were all looking for faults, so, you know, you had to be on your toes all the time. Everything had to be spotless. I mean, there was no laxity at all in the discipline. It was just as strict as it was on land.
Naval officers didn't come and inspect you?
Never came in contact with them. Yes, we did. Sorry about that. We had occasional talks about what to do and how to take a position, how to get into a lifeboat and things like that. But they were very rarely. But apart from that, you never saw the captain. You could look up from your decks up to the bridge and you see them on the bridge, but the bottom of the stairs, as I called, up to the bridges, they were all at a military place guard on, and the bottom stopped anybody attempting to get up there. And that was the same. There were various civilians on the same ship. There was nurses and that who were segregated again from you, kept very much from you, very much apart, and military police again surround them so you couldn't get near them even. You got a glimpse of them and you were lucky.
What was the food like?
It was far better than the land, I must be honest. I don't know why, but whether it was the sea air what made you more hungry, but the food was better. I suppose the main reason was your ship was travelling from port to port, country to country, so it was taking stocks on board what were absolutely unobtainable in England. So overall the food was much better than what you got on land.
Did you have a canteen for
yes,
pleasure?
Yeah, you had your canteen where you could buy your cigarettes and your shaving soap, your washing soap and things like that. I do remember you had to have, which took some getting used to, your ordinary soap was absolutely useless because it was all seawater for your showers and ablutions, and you had this special seawater soap, and that was much better, but you couldn't get a lather with it, so you washed the best way you could. One of the showers put the tanks for all seawater, you see, so it was salt water. It left you sticky rather than clean.
So outside of your occasional duties, you must have had quite a lot of free time.
I can't remember having all that much hours, you know, believe it or not. They found you something to do, the army, all the time. Maybe a little very often. You were free, not during the daytime. I suppose from Reveille, you talk about from 6 o'clock onwards till, say, 6 o'clock at night, you were kept fully occupied with something. It was either lifeboat drill or fire duties or something, or even just cleaning your mess, but you were always something to do. But after 6 o'clock, well, the leisure then you had, the main thing was, you had housey was the thing. You played that, and if you look, I never won anything, but you could win money off the housey. And there wasn't much else, actually, rather. There was, the ship's bulletins, which were always interesting. They never told you much about where you were. At this stage, we still didn't know where we were going. And I remember following, there was games like guessing games for prizes, money prizes, as to how far the ship had travelled in the past 24 hours and things like that. And the one nearest to it won a prize, you know, things like that. But I particularly remember this particular, we're in convoy, and this ship, the Moultown, because it was the largest one, had the commodore of the convoy commodore was on board this particular ship. We never saw him, but we knew he was there. And I remember distinctly taking note that for maybe 6-7 days, we weren't going anywhere near where I expected to be going. In fact, we were heading due east. Now I thought, there's only one place over east, and that's America, traveling due east from RSA. And that's where, of course, the ship basically was traveling east, but it was a zigzag pattern all the way. And that was given the code by hoots on the siren of the Commodore ship. One hoot to port and two to starboard. And the convoy would see the exact, that's how it was going. But basically it was heading east today. But eventually it turned round to the south and started going west. So I didn't know where we were going. But we knew we were going back more to Europe than America. But we were told at that time that we were much nearer America than we were England. And it's very strange because obviously this was to miss the U-boats.